something for the weekend on Saturday. How are you? It is Trina Mari here, and Dave Quinn is here from InvestWise Financial Planning. I spoke to your colleague Enda before, Dave, so nice to have you on. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Trina.
Now, we're all a bit obsessed with money at the moment because there is a lack of money, really, isn't there? So we need to find ways to make our money work harder. And there was an interesting survey done, actually, about this and about how money can affect your health and your lifestyle and your view on money.
Yeah, we surveyed our own clients and some wider connections on a whole range of issues around money, you know, mental health and well-being and what kind of stress it causes people and how much people think about money every day, and then also what it takes to be happy when it comes to money. And, you know, the results were really interesting. There's been a lot of studies around, does money make you happy? The obvious question. And the original study done by Daniel Kahneman, Nobel Prize winner in this area of behavioral finance and, you know, money and happiness, they came out with a figure in the States of $72,000, which is just a very specific number. But the studies they found were that once your household income went above $72,000, your happiness didn't increase much beyond that. I'd say that's out of date now, and it's probably quite a bit higher than that, given inflation and where we've gone over the last number of years. But it's just an interesting study. What we have found with our clients and when we talk to people really is that happiness and contentment are probably two slightly different things. The more your, you know, your wealth and your salary increases doesn't necessarily mean your happiness will exponentially increase. Part of the reason for that is I think our lifestyle expands into the money we have, and we want to keep up with the Joneses to a certain
extent.
That's
it, so yeah. Everyone buying their electric cars and everything at the moment.
Yeah, and bigger houses and private schools and bigger holidays. And, you know, someone who's on $40,000 a year, which is above the national average wage, they feel they'll be happy if they got to 80. And someone who's on 80 feels they're happy when they get to 160. And they see, they feel they might actually be very happy with their lot and their lifestyle and their work-life balance until they see their neighbour driving a brand new Tesla. And then they say, wow, I need to get a bigger bonus because I want one of those as well. And it doesn't make you any happier. We always try and encourage people to take a step back and think about how they feel about money, which we don't really do. We think about our things and our possessions and our salary, but we don't necessarily think about what is it that actually makes us happy. Is it, like, as I'm heading away this weekend down the west for a few days with the kids, it won't be very expensive, but it'll be a lovely bit of time away. You know, that tends to be the types of things that make people happy. And buying a new TV or a new car, you definitely get a bit of a dopamine rush when you pull out of the dealership with your new car and you look great and you like seeing people seeing you in it. That doesn't last very long. Whereas I think memories from experiences or being kind of content with your work-life balance is much more powerful.
Your family history with money can play a huge role in how you manage your own finances as an adult.
Yeah.
Say if you had no money growing up, you might be really driven to earn a lot of money.
Yeah, and it works both ways. I do find that people who had a tougher upbringing appreciate money more when it starts to come and have a hunger for succeeding, and they can often be, you know, really driven, sometimes too driven to earn money and move up the social ladder and, you know, make a success of themselves. And the absolute opposite is very much the case when it comes to people who came from wealthy backgrounds, or, you know, they had parents who were successful business owners. Sometimes have had everything handed to them and it's been quite easy with private schooling and good network of contacts to get their first jobs. The hunger isn't necessarily there and the drive. And, you know, there's a famous old phrase that it takes one generation to build a business and one generation to ruin it again. So, you know, they're gross generalizations, obviously. You get a broad spectrum of attitudes to money and to drive and to, you know, moving forward with careers.
Yeah. When you're doing financial planning with people, I'm sure you get couples in, Dave, who are so different. They're like chalk and cheese. One could be a spender, one is a saver. One worries about money, the other one is so relaxed about it, they don't want to think past their next paycheck.
Yeah, I would say 90% of the couples that come into me, the meeting is driven by the wife or the female in the partnership, and they're the ones worried about money and saving and, you know, putting the children's allowance away to pay for education fees. And it's the husband who is a little bit more relaxed about it and spends on the car and the golf clubs and whatever. Men tend to take more risk, whether it's with the savings and investments or whether it's with career or just general money management. Whereas in my experience, women are more prudent and thoughtful and risk averse. when it comes to managing money. And I don't necessarily want a couple to be either. I want them to think about how they feel about money and what their life goals are together for themselves and their family, and then take the amount of risk they need to achieve those goals. In that survey we did, we found we were surprised at how high the percentage was of people who suddenly felt a lot more relaxed about money when they had those conversations with us and actually put some thought into where do they want to go in life, what makes them happy, and what do they want now, what do they want for their kids, what do they want in retirement, and then, you know, set their stall out accordingly.
So how would you say, Dave, we could improve our relationship with money?
It's taking the time to look at all the little things. The first tip I give people is that there just isn't one quick, easy way to save money and sort your finances out. You have to take a look at about 6 or 7 different areas of your kind of monthly finances and chip away at each of them. The obvious one is shopping around for mortgages, utilities and your bills, and that sounds like a real pain and takes a lot of time, but it doesn't have to be that way. And, you know, if you switch everything in a year, mortgage in particular, it's very popular at the moment to switch mortgages, and the mortgage brokers are out the door with switching requests because there is savings to be made. Shifting your mortgage from 2.5% to 2% saves a significant amount every month. And if that money is going into an investment or a savings account instead, rather than you paying the bank interest, you're earning interest. So it's a double effect. Another kind of an obvious one that you'd hear, like to delve a bit deeper, is on shopping groceries. Obviously, there's a lot of discount supermarkets out there, but that's one thing you can do to save money, shop in the discount retailers. But also, have a look at how much is going into your brown bin every week. I know in my house, our brown bin is always full.
I know, I'm disgraceful. Disgraceful.
So can you shop smarter, not in terms of price, but in terms of what you use, save on what's been thrown out? So
I can't get that balance right at all, Dave. It's either there's too much there and everything goes out of date, or there's nothing there.
I'm exactly the same, and we've recently started kind of more actively shopping in a discount supermarket, and that's not easy because they don't typically have all your favourite bits, so you might end up having to do 2 different shops. But
yeah.
It's practice.
Cars then, Dave. You're not into people buying their new cars.
No, I'm not. Well, look, my view on it is it feels cheap because you're probably, if your old car is a petrol or diesel car, you probably have slightly higher tax rates. And the monthly repayments on PCP finance are very low. If it's an electric car, for example, you're saving quite a lot in fuel at the moment. But nobody factors in the depreciation. And if you're buying a car on PCP, you're going to be paying back that car forever unless you can find a balloon payment at some point to buy it. So if you can manage it, my recommendation is just to hold on to your old car. Like the environmental impact of building new cars isn't insignificant, and that has to be factored in. I personally drive an old car, and I got advice from an environmental expert that with the mileage I do, it's more environmentally sound just to keep the old car. I'm paying a little bit more in car tax, but I'm saving on depreciation, and the car doesn't owe me anything now. It's not worth much, but it's not, other than car tax, not costing me much.
You're not paying out for it.
I feel overall I'm saving, and the money that I'd be paying into buying the car on finance or outright is going into my pension fund and growing.
Yeah.
So that compounded growth over 20 years is hugely powerful.
Yeah.
And people don't appreciate the difference that can make.
I still have regret over a Ford Focus that I let go, and it was my favourite car, and I just let it go because another car popped up in the family that I didn't need, and I said, oh, I'll get that one because that's newer. And yeah, I still grieve. You grieve the cars that you lost. But anyway. Investing as well, instead of just having your money sitting there.
Yeah, this is becoming really topical now that we're seeing inflation rates probably close to 7%, certainly over 8% in the US, and Europe is catching up fast. So if you're leaving your money in the credit union or the bank, you're losing 7% of its value every year. And that's going to continue. I don't think we're going to see really high inflation rates for 10 years, but it's going to continue for a few years anyway, we think. So you're losing purchasing power on that money every year, but it's safe in the bank. You know what you're losing, I guess. Whereas investing, there's a risk involved. That, you know, if you look at the stock market, it moves up and down every day. And more days are good than bad. It does tend to trend up over time. But the Ukraine crisis in February, stock markets fell 10-12%. And people don't like seeing their savings falling, but it's only a temporary fall in value. If you look out long enough, the growth rates on the stock market are very strong. You have the stomach for it and the patience to ride out the falls. And
you just can't need the money now or in the next year or the next 2 years. It's down the line. Yeah.
Yeah, if you need it now or in the summer, you really can't take the risk and you just have to accept the inflation rate. But for anything longer than that, you really need to be trying to beat inflation. And if you can get some tax relief and tax breaks on it as well, through pensions or other structures, that's even better. Like, I'm 25 years at it.
Yeah.
It actually is really, really simple, but it's not easy. The problem most people face when they invest is emotional reactions and reacting to short-term movements. The reason I say it's not easy is because you have to have discipline and stick at it.
You have to almost ignore it, don't you? Forget that it's there. Yeah, yeah.
That's the best thing you can do, is do a Warren Buffett-style portfolio where you buy and leave it alone and lose your passwords. The damage I see with people's portfolios is the guys who fiddle with it every day. It's like a bar of soap. The more you touch it, the less there is.
Yeah, okay. And then finally, Dave, which is a hint, 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 if my bosses are listening, asking for a pay rise.
Yeah.
We're all a bit scared about doing that, aren't we?
I thought you might pick up on that one, all right. You know, why wouldn't you? We have high inflation rates and, you know, a reasonably strong economy at the moment. Things are growing. If you don't ask, you don't get. If you value what you do and you feel you're providing great high value work to your employer, or if you're a company director and you're working very hard in the company, like, if you can't value yourself, no one else is going to value you. So I always feel it's important to ask the question. You can't just go up to your boss randomly on a Friday and say, I want a 10% pay rise. You have to make a case. This is the great work I've done over the last 6 months. Company is going well. I really feel I deserve to be compensated for that and be a part of the growth of the business, and ask for it. And sometimes in that negotiation, which can often happen around a promotion or a contract change or, you know, an annual review, if your boss isn't willing to give you a pay rise, the backup plan for that one is to ask for an employer pension contribution. And employers are going to have to do this now as part of the auto-enrollment scheme that's being introduced in a few years. And that saves them money over paying you directly. If an employer throws some money into a pension for you instead, they don't have employer's PRSI and you get it tax-free into your pension. So that's a backup plan that's actually saving your boss money over giving you a pay rise.
There's a great tip, yeah.
Between the two, like, it's all about negotiation and valuing yourself, knowing what your value is, and then fighting your case.
Absolutely. Well, I'm on it right now, Dave. Dave Quinn there from InvestWise Financial Planning. What is the website if anybody would like to speak to you, Dave?
InvestWise.ie.
Super. Have a great weekend. Enjoy the Easter. Not too much chocolate now. It is something for the weekend and Ireland's Classic Hits.